A father and daughter team up to pay tribute to the printed book. Maine writer Richard Russo and his artist daughter Kate have joined creative forces to offer what they call a last hurrah for the book in our age of iPads, Kindles, and other electronic readers. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls presents a novella and three stories for his latest work, Interventions. Daughter Kate, who graduated from Colby and has a Master's of Fine Arts from the Slade School of Fine Art in London, has created paintings to go along with each of the stories in Russo's new collection, published by Downeast Books. I'm Keith Shortall. Join the conversation. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a message on the Maine Calling Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. Richard and Kate Russo discuss working together, life in Maine, and the future of the book. This is Maine Calling. And Richard and Kate Russo, welcome.
It's good to be here, Kate.
Thank you.
I was doing preparation for this show, and I did some Google searching, and a lot was being written about the form of the book, the structure of the book, as was about the stories that these books contained. And you don't have a problem with that, do you, Richard? In some ways, because this project was about the form to some extent.
Absolutely, that's how this book was really born. Three of these stories have been published elsewhere, although only one of them has been collected. There's only one brand new piece, and actually the content we brought in to supplement the art, not vice versa. What we had in mind was a particular form for a book. Kate and I both have wonderful memories of some childhood books that made this wonderful marriage of art and text. And so that's what we were after right from the start here.
Yeah. Were you concerned about, as we said at the top, this was you see it as a last hurrah, which is somewhat fatalistic view of the future of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that I remember kind of saying it as a last hurrah, and that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, why did I say that? I'm not actually that fatalistic about the book. But here we go. Now I have to defend it everywhere we go.
It's in print.
And I'm not actually that fatalistic about the book at all. It's a book that, I was saying that we really needed ebooks for this book to exist in this technology. Is really made people interested in the different ways we can publish books now. And so without that, we probably wouldn't have ever come up with the idea to do this book in this kind of a creative project.
And this particular book, really can't be recreated on a Kindle to the extent that it's in what I guess you call in the biz a slip case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was one of the things we decided we wanted to do. Really, it's not an anti ebook; it's a very pro book. I mean, but we wanted to make sure. And one of the reasons that we went to Down East was that I had done another book with them before, and we could talk about this. But with a good small press publisher like Down East, we could say right up front, we want there to be no electronic version of this book because there can be no electronic version of Kate's paintings. So that was one of the starting blocks.
Yeah. So as a father and daughter, you've had these conversations for years, I guess, about this. It wasn't a recent idea.
No, our evening discussions over the years as the family's gotten together for significant and not so significant occasions, we've been talking about the language of art, Kate and I in particular, for decades, for as long as Kate has been interested in art, As I've been writing, I have sometimes been writing about artists, and so whenever I'm writing about an artist, I'm always talking to Kate about that, and she's very interested in the language of how the language of art is similar to and how it's different from the language that I use in narrative storytelling.
Yeah. So, Kate, your mission was to do paintings that go with each of the stories. How did you go about that?
Yeah, I was, and that's an important distinction as well that you say that because I am by no means an illustrator. That is a completely different art form, I have no business calling myself an illustrator. But what I really wanted to do was to take a moment from each story and really see if I could try to define the story in one moment and capture that visually. And so they're not narrative paintings. They're actually very still paintings for that reason. That was my challenge, was to say, can I somehow capture the mood of the whole story in one moment?
Yeah. You're obviously biased as the father, but she accomplished her mission, Richard.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My favorite of these, because it has something to do with the story, but also because it has something to do with this father-daughter relationship. I think my favorite of the paintings is the one that accompanies my story, Horseman. Because when Kate and her sister Emily were little, I used to read to them every night from the Child's Garden of Verses. And there's that wonderful poem in there called Windy Nights. And I used to try to terrify them at night and read, whenever the moon and the stars are set, whenever the wind is high, all night long in the dark and wet, a man goes riding by. And, you know, so that was part of their childhood, me trying to terrify them at night just before they went to sleep, as any good father would.
Lucky child services.
And then that poem turns up in this story, Horseman, which Kate then gets to channel both her childhood experience of her father trying to terrify her and this adult woman in the story who's obsessing about this poem, which she has not heard until she's an adult. And the painting that Kate does, instead of showing us the horseman, Kate has placed us on the horse. Going through this, you described the landscape.
Well,
this is
yeah,
your painting. You described the landscape.
Well, the landscape. Well, you originally described the landscape, which is he talks about the character runs in the woods every morning before she teaches at this college, and he describes early on in the book as she's running and she's obsessing about this poem. She finds herself feeling as though she's running to the beat of a horse clumping, and she's going through the forest that gradually turns into a cemetery. And I just thought that was one of the darkest things that my dad had ever written, and I just had to paint it. That was easy. That was an easy one to solve.
And the theme of obsession is one that ties all of these stories together. Can you talk a little bit about why these stories were chosen?
Yes, obsession and intervention. A lot of these characters are obsessed by something or other, and very often, whatever it is they're obsessed by has taken over their lives in some way to such an extent that they can no longer handle it themselves, and someone has to intervene in some way. I think the Russo family, speaking for myself, the Russo family, we've always flirted with various obsessions. I had them when I was in college. I once got addicted to a pinball machine, Keith. You wouldn't believe it. I used all my meal money. I would go to bed hungry because I was stuffing quarters in this yeah. In this pinball machine, and the strange thing is that the last of my obsessions, none of which I've ever really won the battle of, I've just replaced it with another, and the last of my obsessions has really been writing, but it felt to me when I started writing seriously, it felt like all of my other obsessions. It was just something I had to do. And so these characters and the ways in which, I mean, my father was, for a significant part of his life, was a compulsive gambler. There's just this strain, I think, in my family that I've written about it a little bit, but not an awful lot. But when we were looking for a theme, and Kate's paintings, Kate's work, is very obsessive as well in terms of the patterning of her.
You need only to look at my work to see that I'm obsessive. It's pretty plain, pretty plain as day to anybody who looks at it. So it was a theme that's familiar to me, certainly, that people become, especially creative people, which my dad's characters always are. Even if they're not necessarily in a creative field, they think creatively. And I think creative people do naturally become obsessed.
Yeah.
In the novella, which is the new piece, mm-hmm. the unpublished piece, it's the story of it seems like another middle-aged man who's yep. come to a point in his life where he's coming to terms with some things he's not come to terms with, and thinking about what's in store for him at a crossroads, kind of a thing, which is a place you tend to go to or are comfortable in terms of writing and some of your characters.
Well, watching middle-aged men circle the drain, Keith. I don't know how old you are here, and we won't go into it. But strangely enough, watching middle-aged men circle the drain, especially for a comic writer, it's amazing that as a formula, it works damn near every time.
There's a lot of material.
So, I mean, that old Kate Magic and Straight Man, and I've come to it here in a slightly darker way, but I think with this character, he's in a particularly odd place because he needs for someone who loves him to intervene in his life at exactly the same point that he needs to intervene in somebody else's life. So the conflict of the story is watching a man who's lost control of something that he really needs to address. Yeah. That's going to cause him great trouble if he doesn't.
Yeah.
That he can only do that. He can only accept the intervention into his own life if he can perform an intervention in somebody else's.
Right.
So that yeah.
And just to put a face to this character. He's a realtor.
Yeah.
We don't need to give away too much. It's not an incredibly long piece, but it's not a it's hard. I don't want to give too much of the story away.
But he's
a realtor, and he has a house that he's trying to sell, and there's a friendship that he's also trying to come mm-hmm. to terms with, and a past.
And, as always, a past. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I want to get back. Let me give the number here, too, and get back to the conversation about this notion of the book as a tactile thing. The number mm-hmm. to join the conversation today, 1-800-399-3566, to talk to Richard and Kate Russo. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I once sat on a panel with a self-described bibliophile. That's mm-hmm. how he described himself. And I thought, what that meant was that he had a love of learning, or he loved reading and whatnot. As it turned out, no, he actually had a love for the touch, the smell, and the look of mm-hmm. books.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a little bit of that in all of us, or is that something that you think is going to go away?
I think it is going to go away. I think that's the unfortunate truth of it. I think it's an interesting situation because I think when you're actually talking about just text, certainly people of my generation have a lot of reasons why ebooks make sense, and their reasoning for it, you know, environmental reasoning alone, it makes sense to read text on a screen and not waste paper if you can. So it's really been a way to think about just how can we make people want to buy books again. You know, we're seeing it throughout. My husband's a photographer, and just watching cameras slip away into a digital age, you know, watching music slip away into iTunes. We're watching all these things slip away. And
newspapers.
Yeah. And my generation, certainly, you know, the people coming out of college now, 10 years younger than me, these things are, they're being raised
so. Yeah.
on them. I mean,
yeah.
they're even, you know, more so. More so than I am. I mean, they don't even do email anymore. Facebook isn't fast enough. It's all on Twitter. You know, I mean, everything is I think you do get a different taste for things. But if a beautiful object is still a beautiful object at the end of the day, at least I'm hoping.
There is also though, a fascination that younger people have with things like, you know, records now. You know, 70s music is cool, and you know, if you can listen to it on vinyl, that's even better. Might books still always have some sort of future to that extent?
Well, they might become retro.
There's
that possibility. Definitely records, Polaroid cameras, all sorts of things that that you can't, as soon as you can't get it anymore, they'll want it.
That's so cool.
That's an awfully small niche, though.
Yeah,
we hope that books don't go into that. I think we don't know. I think we don't know, and that's part of what this book is about: is a conversation about something that we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen to the book. I think that some really interesting things are happening. As Kate was saying before, in terms of the environmental aspect of all of this, I think it's always been true that probably the majority of books published anywhere are not worth the paper they're printed on. But we can't agree which ones are which.
Right.
But what's happening now as a result of being able to make one click and 2 seconds later having a book on your iPad or your Kindle is that it's forcing us to rethink what a book really is. And it's forcing us to make a distinction, which we haven't made before, between books that we want to read and books that we want to own, which suggests that we might want to reread it someday. So there are certain things, and we're right in the middle of this. We're too close to see what the end will be. There's a wonderful cartoon in the New Yorker this week of a couple of guys standing in front of a printing press. They've just taken the first book off of it, and one says to the other, "I don't know. As long as people want it, as long as people want stories, they're going to want to read scrolls." And that's it. When you're standing right there, when you're looking at the technology and it's happening right now, it's very difficult to know what the future is going to bring. I think that this division between e-books and regular books, I don't see regular books becoming that much of a niche market. I think they're going to be around, but it's going to be different.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Share your thoughts. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. Richard and Kate Russo, our guests, will be right back.
More than 10% of Maine citizens are veterans, and many of them are coping with PTSD and other mental health issues. This week on Maine Watch, we'll learn about some of the innovative new programs designed to help these vets. From Veterans Court to the VA and even law enforcement agencies, there are more resources in Maine than ever before. Also this week, the movement to provide joy and comfort for hospice patients through song. We hope you'll join us.
And join us for Maine Watch tonight at 8, tomorrow at 9 on MPBN television, and tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 here on MPBN Radio.
Yuja Wang makes her Philharmonic subscription debut in Prokofiev's third piano concerto on our next New York Philharmonic broadcast. Musical America's Conductor of the Year, Jaap van Zweden, will conduct the New York Philharmonic this week.
Join us for the New York Philharmonic this evening at 8 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Richard and Kate Russo. We're talking about their recent collaboration, Interventions, a novella and three stories written by Richard with art by Kate. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You both live in Maine. Richard, you're in Camden, and Kate, you're in Rockland.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about whether I'm just imagining this, or it just seems like a lot of either writers are moving to Maine or writing about Maine in recent years. And what is that about? Is it just that it's cold and isolated and there's nothing left to do but be obsessed with writing?
I think you're right. And it seems it's not just kind of a what I think of as the Blue Hill phenomenon, where in August there are a lot of writers who don't live here the rest of the year, but vacation in Blue Hill. There's a wonderful group of writers up there who do that. But I think there are a fair number of year-rounders now. I think it's not just writers. I think it's artists. I think it's photographers,
creative musicians,
filmmakers. Now there are directors, and you keep hear tell of more people on the acting side of things coming to Maine. Honestly, I don't know. I like the long winters. They are long and they are dark, but I get a lot of writing done. I think there's something ambient going on about Maine. I think you hear people say all the time, God, you know, if things don't work out wherever they're living in. They're living in Tennessee or wherever they're living in. They say, if things don't work out, let's just sell everything and move to Maine.
Right.
There's a sense here, and I think it's linked to something, and it's something real, that whatever the harried pace of life or whatever the societal cultural things that are driving you crazy, wherever it is that you live, that Maine is somehow different. And I think that it is. And I think that creative people in some way are being drawn, if not to the real Maine, they're being drawn to that idea of Maine as a place that's maybe slower, maybe kinder, maybe a little bit less in the cultural vortex.
And I think I read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, that the burden of that vortex begins to fall away as you cross the Piscataqua Bridge. And I'm wondering whether over time that it'll be the Bath Bridge and then the Wiscasset Bridge as more people come here for comfort.
What's the one that goes from Maine into New Brunswick?
Yeah, right. We'll have to widen that. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Pemaquid and Phoebe. Hi, Phoebe. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. This is a really fun conversation. I just called in because as you were both talking about obsession, as well as kind of the tactile characteristics or the tactile feeling of books, I just started reading a book and I'm only 25 pages in and I have very little information, so the description is very vague. I don't even know the author, but the first 25 pages are about the character's obsession with this book that he finds in an old antique store, and how, you know, when he picks up the book, he starts taking on the characteristics of the illustrations, which are fish, in this book, you know, and his hands start getting the purple spots that some of the fish have in the books, and, you know, he just becomes obsessed with this book and, you know, kind of uncovering the mystery of this book that was written by a prisoner, you know, years ago on this island, and, you know, and how
is this
how
called just, Gould? Is this Gould's Book of Fish that you're reading?
Yes. And I've only just started, and, you know, just, but, you know, when you guys were just kind of, you went in from obsession into the tactile feeling, that's just what jumped out to me. And I'm excited to read the rest of the book because I'm assuming that it's about kind of, you know, how this book plays a huge role in his life. And so I just kind of wanted to jump in and share. And
Phoebe, do you have an e-reader?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Are you reading it on an e-reader?
No, I'm not.
Yeah. I remember that book. It was interesting when it was published because each of the chapters is written in a different color ink that the prisoner would actually have had access to. And so when you move to a new chapter, the prisoner has gone somewhere else and is using a different kind of ink. It was an interesting experience. Not only
he's using rock or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know. I read that book when it came out, it was an interesting publishing experiment. Not only as a story in its own right, but also in the way that the book was published with these various inks and.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling, Phoebe. Enjoy the book.
Thanks so much. I'm enjoying your conversation.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Peaks Island and Annie. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a question about the parent-child relationship. I have co-authored a book with my son, a nonfiction book, and I'm now working on a collaboration with my daughter. Mm. And I'm intrigued to hear the two of you reflect on any nuances of shifts in your relationship as father and daughter as you worked on this book.
Is there a lot more yelling?
Probably a lot less.
Kate, I'll let you start off with this.
It's interesting because I'm sure that there has been a shift, but this was the project really up until we're really getting to the collaboration point. Our relationship is on the line now more than ever because because we're going to be spending so much time together over the next few weeks as we go to different bookstores. But actually, when we came to do our parts, we were very much separate. I have a studio in my house and took the material with me and worked fairly silently for 2 months until I was done. And every once in a while, I would email him an image of how it was going and when a painting was finished, and just to kind of keep him up to date and excited about the project. But he certainly wasn't telling me what he thought I should draw or paint, and he wasn't certainly coming to the studio to look and bat around ideas. So it's really sort of two separate projects, one more influenced by the other, that came together. And now as we come together to present it is when it's sort of becoming more of a relationship at this
point.
I'll have to check back with you on that.
What's it like these projects, how have they gone so far with your own children? Have there been stress points or?
Actually, much less than I expected.
Yeah, good.
It's been lovely, and I think one of the things that prompted the question is that the real privilege of working with an adult child on a creative project is that you come to see them as a full artistic partner, which parenting and being parented, doesn't always offer those opportunities. I certainly have always seen my children as fully autonomous human beings to the extent that a parent can.
Sure.
But there's something I haven't been able to articulate or to really get clear about, but some way in which you see them more fully as this separate being that you're working with in a very respectful and listening kind of way. That's just been lovely. That's added another dimension.
But can it be difficult, though? I mean, I'm thinking sometimes on artist collaborations, there's a level of honesty that has to go on that says, you know, that's just not working, and it's okay if you're not invested in some other way.
I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the collaboration. I think if, for instance, you were suppose you're a musician and you are the lyricist in a partnership where somebody else is writing the melody and you're writing the lyrics, chances are, unlike what Kate and I were doing, because Kate was working in her studio and I was working in my office, and every now and then, as she said, she would send me a painting. I felt that my duty, and to go back to what the caller was just saying about when you work with an adult child, it gives the parent a wonderful opportunity to shut up.
Yes.
and you really should take that opportunity. I didn't want to be involved in Kate's creative process. I had too much respect for that. I didn't want to certainly exert any influence, especially as the more powerful member of the collaboration. But I think if you're in a situation where you have to work together every day and you're writing the melody and somebody is writing lyrics that you don't think work, or vice versa, and you have to come together today and tomorrow and the next day, then I think that's an entirely different creative process than what has not been that stressful for Kate and me, and obviously for this caller it hasn't been that stressful either. But I can understand. I work in film now a fair amount, and when directors who are collaborators with actors, when they don't see eye to eye, you can see smoke. So I think it depends. I think, Keith, I think it depends a lot on the nature of the collaboration. And it always, of course, has to do with power, too.
All right, Annie, thanks so much for calling. Good luck on your project. We're going to take another short break, and when we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
About 24 horses a week die at racetracks in the U.S. Many horses run with injuries masked by injected painkillers. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Walt Bogdanich and Joe Drape of the New York Times about their investigation into American racing and why tracks with casinos have higher rates of injury for horses and jockeys. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 1 o'clock today, immediately following Maine Calling, for Ideas from the CBC. Today's program is Rediscovering Titanic, Dr. Joe McInnes's 2006 documentary about filmmaker James Cameron's final visit to the bottom of the Atlantic. They explore the ship of dreams that they originally rediscovered together. That's Ideas from the CBC, following Maine Calling, here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a father and daughter team up to pay tribute to the printed book. Richard Russo is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls. His most recent work is Interventions. His daughter Kate provided the artwork for Interventions. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We're going to go to East Machias and Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. I was born in Bangor. I do black and white film photography. I don't have a computer, and I feel like the character in the Ionesco play Rhinoceros, who says, "I'm not capitulating." Richard, I really enjoyed the film version of Nobody's Fool. I think that's an incredible film, and it's going to hang around for a long while.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. If you're going to teach film writing to film students in a film class, I think you could do worse than just take Robert Benton's script of my novel. And with that script, I think you could teach everything any serious screenwriter wanted to know about how to adapt a novel. People have said to me about that screenplay was so faithful to your novel. And actually, Benton took out about 2/3 to 3/4 of that book. It was just gone. But they're absolutely right. The book is the movie is enormously faithful to the novel in that it's faithful to the spirit of those characters and to the tone of the book. And I think that's what people respond to about that. People who love the book really love the movie too. And
do you do screenwriting? Mm-hmm. Did you get a sort of a new appreciation for the difficulties of that form in the course of doing it yourself?
Well, yeah, and I had that wonderful teacher in Robert Benton, because I did work with him a little bit on the script doctor work. So I knew, I saw what he had done with my novel, which I knew inside out. And then I watched him work on that. And then we made another movie together after that. And when it came time for me to actually start writing screenplays, I knew I had to do those kind of paradoxical things, which is that on the one hand, since you're making a movie and it has to be a good movie, it's already a good book, presumably. But if you want it to be a good movie, that means that there's a pretty good chance you're going to have to be absolutely ruthless with the text. Many of your cuts will be unkind. but you can never be – you can be unkind, but you can never be unfaithful. You can never do something that runs contrary to the author's original intention or the feeling that people who loved that book had for its characters. And you have to protect it on the one hand and eviscerate it on the other. Yeah.
It sounds fun.
Yeah.
1-800-399-3566. We're going to go back to the book discussion now to Bryant Pond and Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome. Bonnie? Well, Bonnie's listening, uh-oh, but she's not on the phone. Okay, well, we're going to go. Okay, we'll try Bonnie in a moment. I do have an email from a teacher who says, I'm a teacher in a local private high school, and we're looking at ways to incorporate e-readers into the classroom. Like most 15 to 18-year-olds, many of our students are reluctant readers. However, we see better class participation when we use digital versions of text in our classrooms. Our challenge as educators is to learn how to best use these digital versions, which honestly are more suited to annotation, search, highlighting, it, et cetera. It's exciting to see students energized by reading whatever the format. Mm-hmm. There are some technical advantages and possibly in the world of learning that where e-readers really are an improvement, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think if it helps kids read, definitely. I know certainly I've known dyslexics in the past who, they need to change the basically the way the letters jump around on the page. Because the text is such a different color from the background of the paper, and you have this kind of film that you can put over it that kind of makes the letters in the back of the paper sort of the same color, and it keeps the letters from jumping around. And I know that that's one of the things that they're working with on the e-readers as well, is to sort of, I think that they're an amazing advancement in terms of learning disabilities.
Well, I don't know, though, whether this is true for everyone, but if I'm looking at text online, I think it looks fine. And then I print it and I find all kinds of errors in it. I can't identify the errors until I print it. I'm not sure what's going on.
I think that's true too. When I was editor at the Echo, it used to drive. I was editor of the news section of the paper at Colby, and the editor in chief would get so frustrated with me because I would print everything off, but I simply couldn't edit it until I saw the words on the page.
It has something to do with our feelings about what's being on the screen being really transient, and so printing it off makes it real in some part of your brain. I'm exactly the same way, yeah. Keith. I wouldn't dream of editing on the screen because I just don't think of the screen as being permanent. You print it off and all the misspellings come up. The transposed letters. All of that stuff just leaps off the page.
It's true enough. Let's try Bonnie and Bryant Pond again. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for taking me back. And I just wanted to say, Mr. Russo, when I finished reading Empire Falls, I just turned to my husband and said, oh, my God, I wish I could write like that.
Thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate it.
I just wanted to say that people of my age, I'm 68, and people of my age and my generation, you know, grew up with the libraries and the textile feelings of books. And I can't imagine... The only person, I have a close friend, the only person around my age who wound up getting either a Kindle or a Nook, it's because she and her husband take many vacations, and it is to lug around, you know,
you
30 pounds of books. It's not convenient.
Yep.
But everybody of my age, you know, within a 20-year range, much prefers holding the book, handling the book, smelling the book.
Yeah.
And I just know that books are going to continue.
Have you tumbled yet, though, Bonnie? I have to ask you. Being 68, I'm 62. I have to ask you: have you discovered the fact that if you get an electronic reader, you can adjust the font?
I understand that.
Okay, all right. I just didn't want you to. I didn't want you to be out there and not know that you could do that.
I get large print many times.
Okay, all right, okay.
Well,
that's the great thing about the e-reader, though, is that you don't have to go into the bookstore and ask for the large print version, which is kind of in its own way humiliating. Where you can just buy it, on your iPad or whatever, and you can just adjust that font, Bonnie. You can make it just as large as you want it.
And no one ever knows.
And no one has to know. It's your secret, Bonnie.
I have to thank my librarian. He automatically knows. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling, Bonnie. Let's go to St. George and Fred. Hi, Fred. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. An observation about the fact that some people are going to stay with the book because it's more durable than electronic impulses. I'm thinking of Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, and the fact that sometimes in places durability of information is challenged and is important. And so that's one reason somebody, I figure why the repopular or the resurrection of vinyl is that people, it's simpler, it's analog. I figure that's why some people like vinyl and that's mm-hmm. why some people are going to stick with a book.
And you know what? We're seeing that, the point you're making, we're seeing all over. In film, for instance, right now, of course, we're seeing the same thing. We're going away from film into digital. And
right.
when Empire Falls was cut, I was in the cutting room for a lot of that. And of course, no tape was actually cut
right.
for that. I mean, you were doing it all digitally.
Right.
And a lot of people thought that as a result of this, we weren't going to have all the problems that we have with film decaying and having to be restored and all of that.
Uh-huh.
But the last conversation that I had with a director friend of mine on this subject said that a lot of people now who are interested in film preservation
right.
are very distrustful of the digital. And in fact, they're backing things up on actual film. So,
Wow.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Fred, thanks for calling. Let's go to Cumberland and Rita. Hi, Rita. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. I just wanted to ask Richard if anyone has shown any interest in making your book Straight Man into a movie. I love the book, and I think it'd be a great film.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I think of all of my novels, that's the one that we could almost guarantee will never be made into a movie because I did a series of drafts of it, oh gosh, about a decade and a half ago. And those were paid for by a studio. And at the end of it, at the last moment, they were just about to start casting. They decided not to make the movie. They did something else instead. They put it in turnaround. And since then, I've never been able to get the rights back. So I have the rights to the novel. The studio has the rights to my screenplay. And unless somebody just comes along buys the rights to my novel and writes a whole new script when a perfectly good script already exists out there, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I enjoyed it, and I'll be thinking of you. I'm going to see my mom this weekend, and whenever I get off the New York Turnpike at the Del Mar exit, I think of you and your dad.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Rita. We've got about 30 seconds left. What's the final word from both of you then on the future of the book? I think you said we just don't know. Is that the takeaway here?
Well, I certainly don't know. Kate, do you know?
Yeah. I think my point of view is probably a little more pessimistic than yours, but that's usually the way. That's usually the way we roll anyway.
Yeah.
So, I think that the vast majority of people are going to be reading from e-readers. As the years go on. But I think that actually could be really positive for the book industry in terms of I've always been the person who buys the book because of the cover. And so hopefully more projects like this marrying art and writing that's what's going to happen, hopefully. That's what happened a lot in the music industry. Certainly McSweeney's has been doing it for a long time, and hopefully we'll just be seeing more of that.
All right, real quickly, you have an exhibition coming up?
Well, I'll be exhibiting at Center for Maine Contemporary Art in September for the biennial. I'm one of 17 artists who will be doing that, so that's the next thing coming up.
Uh-huh.
But we'll be at Nonesuch Books tonight.
Yes, the immediate future of this book tonight is at Nonesuch Books in South Portland at 7 o'clock.
All yeah. right. Richard and Kate Russo, thanks so much for being here today. Richard Russo, the author of 7 novels, including Empire Falls, which won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We received help today from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. Have a great afternoon.